Yes, the Handlers did most of the mining operations for Bomber Command during the war. A mine was had to be dropped from between 600 and 800 feet. It had a little parachute so that it would enter nose first to minimize the damage on impact. It had floating device on it so that it wouldn't penetrate the water too deeply. And they had a very sort of clever fuse on. A minesweeper could do X number of passes without being able to detonate the mine. And it, the X depended on the number of the special nature of the fuse. Well, the particular operation I want to mention that follows the escape of the three German warships from the harbor of Brest, where incidentally Bomber Command had been attacking them regularly, and although obviously not destroying them, creating enough of a problem, so they wanted to, the Germans wanted to get them out of the harbor of Brest on the west coast of France. So they did what was called the Channel Dash. They had very good weather forecasters on their side, I think, because the weather suited such an attempt. The Navy were unable to intercept. The Air Force was sent out on virtual suicide missions to try and find these warships to attack them, but the cloud level was at sea level, so you can imagine there were very few attacks made. But mining. I had taken part in a mining operation, and my logbook tells me that I planted successfully a mine near north of Terschelling Island, which is one of the Frisian Islands off the coast of Holland. And I did this operation early in February. A book written by Terence Robertson called Channel Dash, published by Evans Brothers, London, said this on page 165. The Nisenau, which is one of these two heavy cruisers, there was the Scharnhorst, the Nisenau, and the small light cruiser, the Prince Eugen. The Nisenau, making a good 27 knots in waters where she should normally have sailed at 10, stumbled across the marker boats lying off the Frisian Islands, where the route turned sharply eastwards for the run-up to Terschelling and the Elbe. Thankfully, Captain Klein gave the order to alter course, and the great ship heeled over between the markers and headed down the last lap. 11 minutes later, at 7:55 p.m., a brilliant flash bathed the ship in a pale glow for a fraction of a second, then a tremendous explosion rent the silence. The battle cruiser shuddered under the impact and limped slowly to a stop. A mine had been struck. Damaged repair parties swarmed below to investigate the extent of the wound. She lay drifting in the tides only 6 miles from Terschelling. Half an hour later, the gaping rent in her bottom near the stern was blocked by a steel collision mat, and with water pumps operating, Nisenau picked up speed to resume her passage. Later in the book, page 190, the proud Nisenau was so badly damaged by the mine and in an air raid later carried out by Bomber Command that she took no further interest in the war. Page 191, the Board of Inquiry report stated that the sacrifices had been salvaged by the mine-laying operations of Bomber Command a few days previously. Well, obviously we weren't the only aircraft laying a mine off Terschelling a few days previously, but it might have been my mine. So it's a very fond recollection I have. And one of the virtues, I suppose, of reading post-war histories of the war and discovering some of these things. Yes, I have one other observation related to the war. And I must be careful how I put this. When I first joined 49 Squadron in 1941, we had a real Commonwealth squadron. Australians, Canadians, New Zealanders, Rhodesians, Welshmen, Scots, English. It was the British Commonwealth in a kind of reality that was quite striking. But the major Commonwealth countries realized the imperative of deriving, you know, command experience out of the war, you know, commensurate with the resources and strength they had. So, one by one, we saw a New Zealand squadron formed, a Rhodesian squadron formed, Australian squadrons formed, a Canadian bomber group formed, because Canada by far made the largest contribution to the strength of the Royal Air Force bomber effort during the war. But of course it did mean concentrating these nationals in their contingents. Now the Canadians in the RAF were given a choice. Obviously it was wished that they would transfer to the Canadian Bomber Group, but some simply couldn't face giving up the companionship that they had, you know, developed and enjoyed and elected to stay with the RAF units that they were with. But in a sense it was a pity that it had to happen, although one recognizes, you know, clearly why it was necessary to develop and evolve this command experience. But I don't think anyone that took part in those early days with that kind of mix will ever forget the reality of the British Commonwealth at that time. A very, very real thing. And because, you know, they are very different. The English, heck knows they're different from the Scots or the Irish of the world. Which brings me to one other story, maybe the last anecdote anyhow. During that first bomber tour, we had a wireless operator air gunner who was Irish. And what's more, he was Southern Irish. You know, his country was ERA. And ERA was not only supposed to be neutral, it was supposed to be anti-British. But nothing was more remarkable than the number of Irish that smuggled themselves across the border and joined up in the British forces. In fact, I sometimes used to think there were more Irish per capita in the British forces than anything else. Well, anyhow, we had one of these fellows, and we felt very guilty when we... incidentally, when you're on operational squadron, you were entitled, if you lived that long, to a week's vacation every 61 days. Don't ask me why 61, but every 61 days you're entitled to a week's vacation. When we took our first vacation, we were brutally conscious of Pat, our wireless operator economist. I mean, there was no way he could go home for his week until we hit upon the idea of talking our station commander into allowing us to give an extended flying test to one of the aircraft that had been damaged and had been repaired. And we flew Pat over to Aldergrove, which is just off Loch Ness in Northern Ireland, in what we call Ulster. Let him out, and of course on the aircraft he changed into civilian clothes, and we told him that 7 days later we would be there to pick him up, and we couldn't do without him. And he duly smuggled himself across the border, visited his home and friends, and came back, and we picked him up a week later. To me, a delightful piece of the war.
This is the end of the interview with former Wing Commander Stanley Mansbridge.